Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the podcast, I am joined by PGA Tour golfer Joel Dahmen to talk about life on the PGA Tour, the U.S. Open, the Sung Kang incident, what it's like to be an underground fantasy golf hero, and just sort of Joel's life and journey through the minor leagues of golf up to the PGA Tour, what it's like to play with Tiger. If you have liked our previous athlete interviews in the past, I'm sure you'll like this one. If you're interested in golf at all, professional golf, this will also be a great episode for you. We are, of course, presented by DailyRoto.com. You can get 10% off of the best projections and tools in the industry using the promo code Rory, appropriately enough for this interview. We are also presented by RotoExperts.com, which you can get 10% off using the promo code Matic. That's their NFL 365 package, headed up by yours truly. And as always, if you want to support the show, you can leave a rating and review on iTunes, and you can also subscribe to bonus episodes of the podcast on Patreon, patreon.com/takecast. And now let's get into the episode. All right, everyone, very excited to bring in Joel Dahmen of the PGA Tour, someone that that I love to watch golf. Joel, how are you doing this morning?
Doing good. Doing really good. How about you?
You know, pretty good. Pretty excited to talk. You're the first golfer that we've had on the show. We've had baseball players, football players, soccer players, and I've been trying to find the right golfer to bring on the show for the first time. So I'm pretty excited that that you said yes.
Well, I'm hoping I'm not too big of a disappointment then at the end of this. I hope that people will enjoy it.
No, they will. So the thing that I'm most curious to ask you about is this first question, because you played on the minor tours for a long time before getting your PGA Tour card. You played on the Canadian Tour, some Latin American Tour events, the Web Tour, and I think even a lot of the people that watch a ton of golf don't really understand just how much of a grind it is to get to the PGA Tour. You know, Q School and the Web Tour Finals. Like, I really think it's one of the most insane grinds of any professional sports. So what are some of your like favorite memories from the minor tour grind, and then some of the worst?
Yeah, most people don't understand unless you've really have close friends go through it or gone through it themselves. There's just so many good golfers, and the line between mini tours to, you know, even getting status in Canada now is way tougher than when I was going through, and then to jump to the Web Tour, and then to get on the PGA. The line is so small; it's just razor thin, and you don't get drafted. You don't have contracts. You don't have. It's all about playing. You could play incredible for 9 months. You could play high level tour quality golf for 9 months on the mini tours and make a ton of money. But if you don't play well at Q School, if you have one bad week, your whole career starts over again the next year. So a lot of people don't understand that, where, you know, baseball or football or something, I mean, if you play well 75% of the season, I mean, you're going to move up to the next level. I mean, that's great. And it just doesn't work like that in golf. You could play terrible all year long, and then you play well at Q School and you get through to the next level. And then, you know, all of a sudden you're on the Web Tour. And if you play well in two or three events, or you know, somehow keep getting to the Web Finals, all of a sudden you have one good week here on tour. So you just have to play well at the right time. And I think that's the biggest difference between, you know, golf on the mini tour level versus, other sports in the grind.
And if you got injured playing on like one of the minor tours, like say you have a great season for 9 months and then you get to Q School or the Web Finals and you're injured, like, it's over. Whereas if you got injured at the end of like your college football season, you're still going to get drafted. You're still going to get guaranteed
right,
money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. There's just no backup plan. And I think I'll see people on the road, or we'll meet up again. Oh, whatever happened to so-and-so? And it's like, oh, he got injured, or, you know, he had a family, ended up giving up the game. Like, there's just, it's just so difficult. It's a tough grind, and I think that's why you see guys when they get out there, they're pretty appreciative of it. But you also see guys play 5 or 6 years and do well, and all of a sudden they're back on the web.com tour, or they lose their game for a year or two. It's just difficult with no guaranteed contracts, and no matter how well you play, you have to do it again the following year to keep your job. So that makes it tough. But some of my favorite memories, I mean, I had the best time in Canada with some of my best friends. They just hung out with one last night. I went to dinner with him. But we traveled. We had a group of about 6 or 7 guys, and we would travel event to event, share hotel rooms, go to dinner every night, practice rounds. We would also party pretty hard, which is obviously is the most fun, and you know, all the best memories from that. And we're still all very close, but it's just the camaraderie of the mini tours is pretty fun because everyone's rooting for each other. You all want to play well. You want to get to the next level, and you know, just stuffing in hotel rooms, driving 6 people in a car to the next event. Trying to live paycheck to paycheck, basically, all while, you know, trying to get better and be as good as you can possibly be.
Is that like a big part of the big tour? Like, are guys still going out on Friday nights after the cut on the big tour, or like, does everyone kind of just go their separate ways once it gets to that level?
Yeah, it's even on the web tour, it's still pretty friendly. It's still, you know, people root for each other. It's a lot more people still rooming together. As soon as you get on tour, the money's so big and it's so individual and family oriented, you don't see a ton of that anymore. There's still guys will go out and have plenty of fun. Don't get me wrong. But as far as getting a group together and going out, it's more like, you know, like at the PGA Championship this year, I stayed with Corey Connors and Adam Long and their wives and my wife. So we all made a cut. And so instead of doing something, maybe going in town, into downtown or whatever, we just stayed at our house one more night and we had some drinks and played some card games and stuff. Like that's like kind of what happens as you mature
it's like when you and all your buddies graduate from college and instead of going to the bar on Friday nights, like someone comes over and you have like a dinner party and everyone's home by 10:30.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Don't get me wrong. We still have chances to go out and give it the full go, but those are few and far between comparatively. You know, people are having you know, kids now and money obligations and the hangovers last longer and all that stuff, so the fun isn't as often, but when we do it, it's still pretty darn fun.
Yeah, trying to play like a round of hungover golf on a Saturday at like the Waste Management or whatever, like it just sounds like way too much pressure. It just feels like it would be impossible.
Yeah, I mean, hungover golf, I mean, that still happens with buddies, obviously, when you're back home and stuff like that. But there's just too much on the line on tour. Some guys do it. I'm not going to say I've definitely done it. It's not as much fun. And normally it's when you're in last place going into Sunday or something. But you know, and some people will have some drinks, but there's just, even if you play well on any given day and you have a great round, you move up and there's just still so much money involved. So, some guys will maybe dabble in that, but not many and not as much, definitely, like on the mini tours or web.com tour, that's for sure.
Yeah. So this is actually something I didn't know before I started researching for this interview, but both you and your brother battled through testicular cancer, and you are on record as really saying that battle is kind of what made you what you are today. So kind of how did that transition go from, like, you know, battling through cancer to deciding that you wanted to get back into playing professional golf?
Yeah, that's, I mean, anytime you have a life or death event, I lost my mom to pancreatic cancer in 2005. I was a junior in high school. My brother was diagnosed in the fall of 2009. And then I was diagnosed with testicular cancer in the spring of 2011. So, been through it, more than I'd ever, obviously, you know, wish upon my worst enemy. I mean, I've been through.
Yeah, that's wild.
The worst of the worst. And so, but when you go through it, I mean, it definitely changes your perspective. I mean, watching your mom die is one of the worst things you can ever go through. And then thankfully my brother caught his early. And he was in college at the time, but he had it removed and didn't have to do chemo. So caught his early. Mine, I might have been a little different. I needed to go through chemo. I think I had chemo for about 2 months. And it was, at that time, it was, I was supposed to be playing mini tour golf. I was supposed to be getting ready to go to Canada for my second year. You know, I was kind of hoping to make big strides in my game. And it was just kind of a big setback. But during that whole time, when you're just on the couch and you're not feeling well, yeah, you just, you miss a game and you wonder if you're going to be able to play again at a high level. You wonder kind of what the future holds. And after that, it was kind of a kick in the pants for me. I mean, to really get going and motivated and to, you know, at that point, I didn't want to waste the opportunity, you know, because there's slim opportunities out there in the minor league to golf. So I want to make sure I took advantage of it and that I didn't waste my opportunity, whatever that was. And so it definitely gave me a push to be better and to be, you know, day in and day out, act like a professional golfer, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can't even really imagine being in that scenario. I would like to think that I would have the resilience to fight back from it. So sort of what was your rounding into form as a tour professional? Like what was there a standout moment where you remember really figuring something out in your game? Or do you think that you just grinded long enough that you stopped making the errors and you got consistent enough? Like, how did you become the Joel Damon that, you know, that hits the PGA Tour in 2019?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's probably a couple small points that stand out, but as a whole, you just have to keep pecking away at it. I mean, you just got to keep hitting the stone, and you have to continually do the right things over and over again, and eventually it's all going to pay off, and you have to believe that. For me, I missed it. I played really well the year of 2013, mini tours and up in Canada. And I was at Second Stage Q School, and I had just missed. I think I three-putted like my 71st hole, and I didn't birdie my last, which is a par five, pretty simple par five. I think I missed by two, and two of my best friends at the time had got through at that same site, so they're like celebrating to go to the final stage, and I called my girlfriend, now wife, and I was crying in the car. I was like, you know, this might be it for my career. This sucks. I was good enough to get through. I didn't get through. So that off season, that November, December, I didn't do anything. I sat on the couch. I didn't have a job. I didn't play golf for 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks. And eventually I was living with her, my now wife, and she was told me to get off the couch or get a job or go practice. And so I borrowed $200 from her, and I went and took a lesson. And I've never really taken like a legit lesson in my life, and made, you know, pretty minor change with this guy. But he just kind of gave me a direction to go in, and I went out and won my next two mini tour starts for, like, I won $30,000 combined in the two events. I thought I was like the richest man alive, and that was the swing of 14.
You could at least afford to pay your wife back after the 30K win?
Yeah, I could. Yeah, exactly. I can pay that back. My phone could get turned back on, and then, you know, I could kind of have some flexibility with playing schedule over the summer. So I ended up kind of parlaying the great spring into the summer of Canada, where I won twice early in the year and ended up winning the Order of Merit, which got me on the web.com tour for 2015. So kind of that winter of 13, 14, was a big kind of kick in the pants to get me to, you know, winning on the mini tour level consistently in Canada and getting to the web tour. And then from there, it was just kind of slowly, surely getting better, believing in myself more, trusting myself more, probably on the golf course. And then a couple good breaks went my way on 16 on the web tour, and then got my tour card from there. So, yeah, I mean, probably the biggest moment was taking that lesson in January of 2014 that really kind of got me going.
So where did the bucket hat come into play? At what point in your golf career did you decide I'm going with the bucket hat?
Yeah, so it's amazing, you know, how much it's kind of taken on a life of its own.
It's very good branding for you.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, and there was no real intention of that. But I've lived in Phoenix area for 7-8 years now, and obviously it's really sunny here, and I would throw in the bucket hat quite a bit to practice. Just easy to throw in the hat, keep the sun off you if you're out there for 5-6 hours. And but obviously I wasn't quite willing to pull it out when I was out on tour. And then I didn't have a hat deal my first 2 years on tour, first year and a half on tour, and played Fisher's Island and bought a bucket hat out of the shop as a souvenir, and I wore it the following week and played decent. And so I wore it the following week again is when I played with Tiger Woods on that Saturday, and that's when it kind of blew up, is that I was wearing a Fisher's Island random hat, bucket hat. And from there it was, well, I mean, it's very practical. I mean, it's nice to have the sun off you, keep the sun off your face and your ears and your neck. And then I was surprised with the reaction of it. So I just kind of kept it going through the summer. And now anytime it's sunny, I throw on a bucket hat, and now I have a pretty good hat sponsor from it. And hopefully there's more to come soon.
What was it like playing that first round with Tiger Woods? Like, were you just like anxious? Were you excited? Do you even remember that much from it?
Yeah, I was scared to death. I was pooping my pants all night. I didn't sleep well. It was the biggest, probably the biggest moment of my golf career. Probably up until finishing second in Charlotte. It's people will never understand. Like, I play in front of like 5 to 6 people. I have my wife out there, you know, my other people have their family friends. And then we have like, you know, ShotLink people out there. We have volunteers. They don't have anybody actually watching us. So to go from that to, I don't know, 10,000 people surrounding every single shot you hit is just a whole different feeling. It's like you're playing golf in a football stadium.
Yeah. I don't think people know. At PGA yeah. events, like I went to the PGA Championship in St. Louis on Sunday last year, and I just was like, I just walked and followed Brooks and Adam Scott because the 90% of the people there were just following Tiger's group. Like, it's crazy how many people are right there watching Tiger.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's probably a fair number. 90% of the people on the property are watching Tiger's group. So if Tiger's in the field, it's great because you can watch other really good players and get up close to them because everyone's watching Tiger. So it was just a whole different world for me. He couldn't have been nicer to play with. We chatted quite a bit. He told some funny stories. I mean, he birdied 3 in a row, or 4 in a row in the bunny. Birdied 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And after he birdied 7, I mean, the place was so loud. I think he got to, like, he's only 2 or 3 shots back the lead at that time on Saturday afternoon, and the place went nuts. And I just looked over my caddy with a big old grin, and we were having the time of our life. And, yeah, it's something I'll never forget, but also after that is when I played my best golf. I think if you can play a Tiger Woods on a weekend, somewhat in contention, I mean, it's a big moment for me. I ended up finishing 20th or something around there. So to be kind of played, I shot 1 under that day, so I played decent. And the following weeks after that, I had my best tour finishes, and I think it makes it easier after playing with Tiger. If you can play with Tiger and compete with him under those conditions, I think you can do, they're very similar to a Sunday afternoon, put it that way.
Yeah, and I think, so we hit on a really interesting point there, which is that golf is, I think, probably the sport where the athletes and the people there have, like, the most interaction, both, like, on the course and on Twitter and on Instagram. Like, I follow a lot of golfers, and, like, every time someone wins, like, it's nice to be able to, like, at them and feel like there's a decent chance that they're going to see it. So the first question I have for you is, like, are you aware that there's, like, a decent amount of guys who follow your career pretty closely? Like, specifically, like, a lot of the people who subscribe to Data Golf, which is a site that you've worked with. Like, you're sort of a hero amongst the fantasy golf community.
Yeah, it's really funny. I read, maybe Shane Ryan wrote the article, I think, is the guy.
Yeah, it was him.
Okay, and it was after I played well in Charlotte, and it was really funnering. It was because I'm very into Twitter. I love Twitter because you get instant information. It's great. I mean, I could get every single update from my Seattle sports teams, from Seahawks to the Mariners. You know, you can get breaking news from any situation around the world. It's just a great platform. I think it's incredible. And obviously when you're a nobody on tour, no one really cares about you. And rarely are you picked in the day, you know, in the fantasy sports stuff. I love betting. I love gambling, always enjoyed it. We are not allowed to do as much on tour. Obviously we can't bet. We have to be a little careful with that stuff. So, I've never followed it too closely, to be honest, as far as the golf world stuff. But it's amazing when you start playing well, then you get picked more often. And, you know, obviously, because if you start playing well from nowhere, your value is really good. So it was really funny to me that all of a sudden I was getting tweeted at all the time about, oh, I picked you this week, I'll do well, or, you know, you made me money this week. And all of that started happening more and more. It's almost a consistent basis, which is kind of funny to me because I never really, you know, you never really think about that side of it, but it's a massive side of all sports. And I think it's great for the game. And I'm just happy that I've won some people a couple bucks this last year.
Yeah, it is pretty nice. And one of the things that I know that people have taken a shine to you for is what happened in the incident with Sung Kang, where basically he lied about where his ball went out of play. I don't remember the tournament that it was at, but you were not shy about the situation, about saying, like, no, Sung Kang, he cheated on this shot. Like, is that something you're comfortable speaking out about?
Yeah, The tours put a little bit of a silencer on me on that one, but people can go do their own research on that. It's an interesting thing because it probably happens on tour more than people think, and not you know, it's not maybe 230 yards or maybe 200 yards, but 10 or 15 yards or just a little bit of this to get a better angle. It's amazing how often it goes on, but the other thing is you can't. I mean, it's tough to argue it because, I mean, it's a little bit objective. You don't know exactly. I mean, you're 200 yards away or 300 yards away a lot of time when the ball goes in the hazard or goes into. So it's not always cut and dry. But I was very comfortable in my position, and I think that I was kind of fed up with it for a while. So I did my best to protect the field and you know, play by the rules of the game, I guess. I mean, which is number one in golf. And when you're out there just two sums and you have the rest of the field, I mean, it's your job as the marker, the guy who's keeping the other guy's score. It's your job to protect the field, as we say. So, unfortunately it went down that way. But I will say most of my peers, I would say almost all of my peers, are in agreement with me. And that's helped me sleep at night. And, I don't regret what I did, put it that way.
Yeah, I think that's fair. So you have to tell me about the Hack Masters, which is something that I found researching for this interview. And then what are you going to do about not going to this yearly event when you get invited to play at Augusta?
That's classic. Yeah. So, the Hack Masters is a two-man event the weekend of the actual Masters. You and a partner, you play best ball one day and then scramble the next. There's a Calcutta. There's some parimutuels. There is, you know, a ton to side bets, whatever you want. They do a great job hosting it. You're basically drinking for 48 hours straight. You start on Friday night at the welcome party, and you go. And so you play Saturday you play early morning, 7 a.m., and then you go back to the bar and you watch the afternoon golf or the Masters, you know, for 3-4 hours, and then you do the same on Sunday. So this is my fourth or fifth year playing. I really play with my caddy, Gino, and we have a ton of fun, and he's a pretty good golfer. So we've done well in the past, and this year ended up playing with my, I guess you call him my father-in-law, but they're not quite married. But he's got a bigger handicap. So he's got a 15 handicap, but he hits the ball really far. So he's got to play the FTs. We ended up doing really well. But it's just a really fun event. You have Pat Perez has always played in it. Brandon Harkins, another tour player. Jimmy Gunn. So you have some four or five pros who play in it with some partners. And it's just it's one of those things. If you get caught without a beer in your hand, you might have to take a shot at doing a round type of thing. It's a 48-hour party, and it is so much fun. And the hangovers that you have after the first day and then have to tee it up and do it again the next day is pretty tough. So it's kind of funny because Pat played it forever, and then he won like in like 15, 16, or 16, 17. Like, so he was in the Masters for a couple years in a row, and everybody was kind of complaining to him, like, dude, you're missing the Hack Masters. Go play in the silly other golf tournament in Georgia. And it's kind of funny because I didn't really think, I don't know. I mean, I've played so well lately. In like last year, I've never really thought about, you know, the next steps and winning and playing in Augusta or getting the tour championship and all that stuff. But as it becomes more of a realistic possibility, I'm getting more and more people around here in Phoenix giving me crap about potentially not playing in the Hack Masters, which obviously is a great problem to have. But it is a super fun event that we look forward to every year. And if you play well, you can make a little bit of cash, which is always nice.
You're pretty close because you're one of the top alternates for the U.S. Open. Right now, do you have a pretty good idea if a spot is going to open up, or like how does that process even go? Like, who contacts you? Do you just get an email?
Yeah, so it's a dirty little secret about the USGA is they actually hold. So they, if you look at the tee times, there are six TBAs to be announced for alternates or guys to get in, and so. For, they hold six spots for guys who could possibly move into top 60 in the world by playing well this week around the world. So I think like Jazz, the guy who played well at the PGA can get in. Corey Connors, Adam Hadwin, they're all kind of close to getting in if they play well. But it's in the history of them doing this, they've never had more than a couple guys move into top 60 in the world. So with that, then they go to the alternate from the qualifiers, and then they grade the 12 qualifiers 1 through 12 in difficulty of field, strength of field. And me being at Columbus, the first alternate at Columbus, which is a tour site, I'm the first overall alternate. So they called me the other day and said I would book a plane ticket and find a place to stay for the week because you're probably in the field. So with that being said, I'm not officially in the field until Monday morning. They can't announce anything, but I do have a plane ticket and I do have a house rented, and so does my caddy. So I plan on playing in the U.S. Open next week, although it probably will not be announced until Monday morning.
Have you played at Pebble Beach before?
Yeah, so I played the previous 2 years. My first and second year on tour, I played at Pebble, and this year I actually sprained my foot, so I wasn't able to play at Pebble this year, which is unfortunate because it is my favorite golf place in the world. Absolutely love it, and love everything about it. Love Carmel. You know, the golf course is awesome. The people are great. So this can be the biggest event like that I'm most looking forward to I've ever played in by far. Like, this is huge for me. I've always loved the U.S. Open. I've enjoyed watching it more than the Masters even growing up. And I think for it to be at Pebble Beach, my favorite golf course in the world, I'm super excited for it. And I can't wait for next week.
How difficult do you think that they're going to make it compared to how the Pro-Am plays? Like, have you talked to anyone who's already there or like to get a sense of like how crazy the rough or the greens are?
Sounds like the rough is going to be absolutely gnarly. I heard they're going to try to graduate the rough. So if you're only a couple feet off, it'll be much less than if you're 10 yards off the fairway. But I've not been there yet. But it, you know, some people have taken a walk around. I know Phil was out there the other day, and sounds like the rough is ridiculous. But one thing I also heard is that Pebble was super annoyed or pissed off at the USGA because the last two times they're there in 2000 and 2010, maybe, is that they completely ruined the greens for like the whole, you know, the rest of the summer, basically. Yeah. Because, you know, overbaked them. And then Pebble's pissed because they can't charge as much for their rounds because their course isn't in good shape. So I have heard that the greens will not be as firm or as baked out as they have been in the past. Now, they're still going to be firm. And Pebble's greens are so small and they have so much slope, they don't need a ton of extra stuff to make them difficult. But I don't think you're going to see them going brown and even that purple color because Pebble wants to make sure their greens are still good after the event. So I'll be curious if that's true or not, and how that comes out. But either way, there's a couple of pictures out there of how narrow the fairways are compared to when they normally are. So the fairways are going to be cut in half almost. And then the rough is gnarly, which is classic U.S. Open. And then you have small greens with a bunch of slope. So I imagine it's going to be a tough test, but it's also not overly long compared to like Bethpage,
right?
Which was just a joke for how long it was playing. And I think Pebble is going to be a fair test. And I think you might see, you know, somebody besides the Bombers win there, which would be great.
Yeah, so what kind of player do you think will win? You don't think it's just going to be Brooks and DJ at the top again? Well, I mean, it could be, obviously, but maybe not a course that's built just for those two?
Well, when I showed up at Bethpage, I knew that Bombers were going to win. Like, we just, a guy like me, it's an average. If I played great that week, I'd maybe sneak in the top 15. But I had no chance of actually competing for four rounds out there. I think at Pebble, you're going to... Now, the Bombers always have a advantage because they hit the ball long and straight, and that's awesome.
Yeah, it's easier to shoot a 120-yard second shot than 160-yard second shot.
Exactly. So, and even if you're in the rough, if I'm in the fairway at 170, or if I miss a fairway and they miss a fairway, they have a wedge in and I have 7-iron. Like, it's just totally different. So, I mean, they're the best players in the world, so I would be stunned if they weren't around there, but I wouldn't be surprised to see maybe a more eclectic leaderboard where you see kind of a mix of games, you know, around that top 10 and around the lead. Because Graham McDowell won there in 2010, he's not a Bomber.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be shocked to see maybe, you know, all sorts of games up and down that leaderboard. I think that's a testament to how great Pebble is and hopefully how great the championship is.
Yeah. So Data Golf actually powers the fantasy golf and the gambling products at the website that I work at, Daily Roto, and they did some work with your coach at the end of the 2017 season. So sort of what was the process like of implementing the data that they gave you, and kind of like how often are you leveraging that information in your rounds in terms of like not even just their stuff, but just analytics overall?
Yeah, so it's something that I think, well, if you're not using the data out there of some sort, whether, you know, and there's quite a few out there now, and if you're not using it in some shape or form, then you're not taking advantage of everything at your disposal. So I don't do it directly too much. My coach, Rob Rochelle, I've been with him for 4 years now, and he's great at that stuff. So he reaches out to everybody, talks with all of them, sometimes on a weekly basis to see where my game's at or every couple of weeks and gets a report. And he just shares the info with me that I need. Sometimes if you can go down the rabbit hole of it and you start maybe doing too much of one thing, or you think, you know, you're actually thinking about it when you're out there on the course competing, which is not good. You know, you'll want to be like, oh, I'm struggling right now from 150 yards to 175 yards. So I should try harder on this shot or do better, or, you know, or I'm struggling from here, so I'm going to hit a bad shot type of thing. So he just steers me in the direction I need to go. And I think almost every single tour player is doing it in some form or fashion. I think Data Golf, it's great because they don't have an actual golf background. They're just really smart guys who run their algorithms or run their program, whatever it is. I don't know a ton about it. But I think they do a great job because it's just purely numbers based. Where, you know, Richie Three Jack is another guy who does well. He does a weekly report. And I think he's good at what he does. And then there's a couple other. I know Zach Johnson has his own guy. There's another one who just came out kind of this morning. Is it Luce Fagner, maybe, is some people are looking at him. It's an interesting way. And it's, I know all sports are kind of going analytics. I know it's a big thing for baseball, and even hockey's going that route, and football is doing some changing. So I think if it's at your disposal and it's, and the numbers are there, you can't really deny them per se. So I use it every week in my strategy and my practice, and I think a bunch of other players do. And I think it's very interesting to see how it all breaks down, basically. I've improved in almost every metric from 2 years ago and even last year, and it's showing in my results, whether how big or small it is. It's just you can see improvements little by little, and that goes a long way in the golf world.
So is it sort of like, is the sort of stuff you're looking at, like, maybe not so much, I'm not great from 150 to 175, but like maybe course analysis, like strategy in terms of like, I need to be hitting this club from here or this club from here, or even like tournament selection, like this tournament or this course fits what I'm doing well, so I'm going to play it, or this course doesn't fit, so I'm not going to play?
That's a good question. I haven't had the luxury of doing that yet. I think I'm at that point now. Obviously, I locked up my card earlier in the year. So there are some where I'm starting to take a couple of events off, which is nice. Up until this point, I was just playing every week I got in. But it's kind of nice to have weeks off and to recharge and do that. And I think that is something I'll definitely look at going forward next year. Be able to plan out my schedule a little more. But I use the strategy a lot to not so much like what club to hit or going for it in par fives is huge. Stats show you should go forward as much as possible and hit driver as much as possible. And I do those things as far as that's concerned. But more for us, it's more targets off the tee, and it's understanding your dispersion and your shot pattern. And, you know, because we don't hit it perfect very often. That's a big myth probably for tour players. We miss it a lot.
Yeah.
And it's making your misses go to the good spots or the correct side of the hole. So you have an easy up and down, or you have an easier two putt. And so I use a lot of that stuff. I work with John Rehorn, who's done, it's called Golf IQ. And he every day he tells me, he sends over a PDF and he shares with my caddy and myself. And we go through our book and make sure that, you know, we're aiming at the correct targets and we're underneath the hole. And that type of thing. Not so much, we don't use it, you know, like, hey, we got it 7-iron from here per se, because conditions change too much. But we use it every day, every shot, in the fact that, you know, where guys getting it up and down from, where are they making birdies from on par five, that type of thing. And I think it's been a huge help.
I think that is actually probably a big misconception, is that people think that the golf ball just goes wherever a tour pro wants it to go, and that if they miss, it's because they aimed wrong or whatever. So I think like focusing on good misses, or if you are going to miss, where it should go, I don't think a lot of people would think that that's something that a tour professional even ponders when they're standing over the ball.
Yeah, it's the biggest misconception. I don't think the announcers do a great job of it either. Every time somebody misses a putt, it's because they misread it, and that's just not true. I mean, we still pull and push putts all the time, but the average tour player's dispersion off a tee with a driver at 300 yards is like 60 yards wide, 65 yards wide. So people can't fathom that. But if you take 20 golf balls of an average tour player and you just have them hit at a middle target, they're going to have 60, they're going to have 30 yards left and 30 yards right of that target, which people just can't comprehend that, but it is true. Now, when you're playing well, obviously your dispersion is a little bit better. But over the course of a year, that's what it's going to be. And then it's even into the greens. I mean, people don't realize from 125 yards, I think our average, maybe it's 110 yards, our average shot is like 20 feet. Like, yeah, we hit a couple close, but we also hit some to 30 and 40 feet. So And, you know, people just don't realize how many shots we miss and how many don't actually come off perfect the way, you know, that we design them to or we want them to. I mean, people see on the coverage, it's just a highlight reel. I mean, you see the leaders, you see the three or four leaders, and they're mostly playing well. I mean, you do see some titular shots, but everything else you just see from every other player is just highlights. They just pan out, like, okay, and Joel Damon on number 12 from 30 feet, and he makes it, or, like, he hits a wedge close. Like, that just doesn't, I mean, that's just not real golf. Like, go out and watch a random three ball on Thursday morning, and you're going to see people hit it everywhere and miss a bunch of greens and miss a bunch of putts. It's just the facts. So I think that's the biggest misconception of pro golfers. And even, like, I'm going to go play with some buddies here in a couple hours here in Scottsdale, and, I mean, they still give me crap. I mean, I'm going to shoot a couple under par probably, and they're like, oh, man, like, should be shooting a million under out here. I'm like, well, I mean, golf is really hard. And, you know, I don't make every 8-footer, and I don't hit every shot close to the hole. So it's an interesting misconception probably. And I think analytics are doing a better job of, you know, showing that.
I mean, like, the top skill for the very best golfers in the world is just, like, consistency, right? That's the way it's always been explained to me, is that, like, you know, an amateur golfer, like, someone who's not good could shoot a 69 at, like, a municipal course one day and have the round of their life, and then they might shoot an 85 the next day, but, like, the better you get at golf, the closer you are to just always having good rounds and, like, playable shots.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, the biggest difference is our misses are still in play or still in decent spots where we can make par from or even still make birdie from, where the average, you know, 8 or 10 handicap is going to have a ton of misses, but they're going to go in the water. They're going to go out of bounds. They're going to go behind the trees. And it is. It's like, yeah, one day they can play great, but the next day they might shoot 85. And that's, you know, that's just a huge difference, but also the courses people, like, people have no idea how tough our setups are. Like, the tee boxes are almost always all the way back. The pins are tucked on the corners by the bunkers, by the water, over ridges. You know, it's completely different than people can imagine. I mean, when we play in the pro-am, we play with a 10 handicap, they almost never break 90. Like, it's just a different world out there. And people don't realize that too. It's like, oh, I shot a 70 at home and you shot 71 on tour. Like, well, I'd probably beat you by 10 if you came out here and tried that. So it's a whole different world. And that's what's maybe even more impressive when these guys go to super tough golf courses and they, like what Koepka did on Thursday at the PGA, I think he shot 63, 7 under. Like, I shot even par and played unbelievable. And I was like, there's just, people just have no idea how good that is. And obviously, I mean, over the course of 4 days, it kind of caught up to them on Sunday, but people just don't appreciate how good of golf that is.
Yeah, the courses are long, the rough is, like, unplayable, the greens are fast, every pin position is in, like, the most diabolical place a pin could ever be. Like, it's set up for, like, a bad golfer to shoot 120. Like, it's just, it's crazy how those courses are set up.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think, I mean, we're 3 or 4 paces from every edge of every green. So, it's funny to watch, you know, some people come out and try and play, and they realize how difficult it actually is. and that's why you see guys shooting, the best players in the world shooting 75s. I mean, I shot 79, shot 77 at Muirfield, shot 80 at San Antonio, I shot 79 at Bethpage on Sunday. Like, it's just not that hard to make bogeys on tour. It just takes a little bit off. So, I mean, that's why when you're playing well and you're making some birdies, it's that much more fun.
Yeah. All right, so last question. This has been a year of firsts for you. This is your real emergence. Your first time in contention at a PGA Tour event, losing to your buddy Max Homa, first time playing in the Players' Championship. Is there one hole or round that would stand out as, like, your favorite moment of this year on the PGA Tour?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I really enjoyed the Players' Championship. I thought that was I thought that was more of a major than the PGA was for me. It felt that way. I think Sawgrass is an incredible golf course. Anybody can compete there. I mean, you saw Rory win. I mean, Furyk, I got to play with Jim Furyk on Sunday, and, you know, he almost won. I think playing with Jim Furyk coming down the stretch at Sawgrass at the Players' Championship was incredible. I birdied. I think I was 3 under early on Sunday, maybe just 2 under. And I was kind of hunting around. I think I was only 2 back with 7 or 8 to play. It was on the front. But anyhow, I had my chances. And then just kind of playing that back nine with a lot on the line means a massive purse. Watching Jim try to chase down the leaders, which was awesome. And then at 16, 17, 18 at Sawgrass, there's nothing like it, especially when you're in for a big payday on Sunday or trying to watch Jim win. We both made birdie on 16, and we get to 17T, and I mean, the first couple days, it's downwind, it's just a wedge, it's gap wedge, it's nothing. Like, you don't even blink about it, and all of a sudden, I think I'm in, you know, 10th or 12th place or something, standing on that tee, and the wind's blowing in, and it's cold. I got 137 yards to this tiny pin over on the right, and I mean, that'll make you nervous. And to hit a great shot there was awesome. I hit it to like 10 feet. Unfortunately, I didn't make the putt, but even Jim, like he hit a great shot just behind my ball, hit it like 12 feet, you know, and if he makes that, all of a sudden he gets in a playoff with Rory. But like, you could just tell how jacked up he was. And we were walking the green and everybody's chanting Jim. You know, he's been a member at Sawgrass for 20 some years. He's lived in Jacksonville forever. So it was just really cool scene and how much people were pulling for him. And then on 18, when he got emotional after playing that well and kind of a big bounce back for him late in his career, it was just one of the coolest things. And for me to play well, I mean, that was as much pressure as I've felt. You know, that's just a ton of money on the line coming down those last few holes. So I had a great time, enjoyed that. And, that's something I won't soon forget. And I'm looking forward to the Players every year after that. You know, hitting that shot on 17 late on Sunday is pretty darn fun.
I can't imagine standing on that tee box and looking over that water and knowing the Tiger putt and knowing how much money is on the line. Like, I think it'd probably take me 10 times to get over the water standing in that situation. Like, it just feels like the most nerve-wracking hole in golf, probably.
Yeah, like I said, it's really not too bad. Thursday, Friday, it was like a little downwind, 125, 130 yards. It's just a wedge, and it's really not a big deal. But as soon as the wind flips into you and you got a back 10, I mean, it changes everything. So, I mean, it's a completely different hole Thursday, Friday than it is on Sunday afternoon, I'll tell you that. And it's just a ton of fun. But then you have 18 to play, and 18's really difficult. So, You gotta hit some good golf shots down the stretch there, and I think it's a great golf course. I think it's, I mean, whether people call it a major or not, I mean, it certainly feels like one to me. And it's a great spot. It's a really cool feeling there. And if people get a chance, I mean, they always ask me what to go to. I think the Players is one of the best events to go to.
Yeah, great. For sure. All right. Well, I think that will do it. Thank you so much for the time, Joel. Good luck at the U.S. Open. Let me put you on the spot here real quick. Who wins the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach? You're allowed to say yourself.
I think I'm going to play well at Pebble. I think I'm going to play well next week. I don't think I'm quite ready to win a major, to be honest. But I think I can play well there. So I'd be shocked if I didn't maybe add some value to the DFS world. But I want Phil Mickelson to win. I want him to get his U.S. Open. Who do I think is going to win? That's a tough one.
Brooks is the favorite right now.
Yeah, and I mean, you can't go against Brooks. I mean, he's incredible, but it's just so hard to do what he's doing. So I'm going to go with DJ. I know that he's maybe not in the exact form, but I'm going with DJ at Pebble. He's played well at Pebble. He wins it all the time at the Pro-Am. He was in contention in 2010 there. So I'm going with DJ for the winner, hoping Phil wins, somehow pulls it off and gets his U.S. Open, and I think I'm gonna play well. So whatever that means, I'm not sure, but I know I'm gonna enjoy it.
All right, there we go. Joel, thank you so much for the time.